wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
We are joined in studio by our Professor Alan Blackman, by our expert Professor Alan Blackman, even.
Oh dear.
Goodness gracious. I don't host Dear Science that often. It's not my area of expertise. How are you, Alan?
I'm good, Joel. And this is the last one for the year.
This is the last Goodness, Dear
the
Science
last, for the last Dear Science for the year.
How has your experience in Dear Science been this year?
Well, it's been very quick.
Yeah,
I think like it is every year, honestly. Just every successive year just seems to go more and more rapidly, which is never good.
Yes,
at my age, no.
Look,
no.
I'm 24, and you know this year went by in a blink of an eye.
Yeah.
How long have you been doing Dear Science, by the way?
It would have to be about 8 years now, I think.
8 years?
I think, wow. Yeah.
And you're not sick of us yet?
Oh, God, well, as long as you're not sick of me, then yeah.
We're definitely not sick of you, don't you worry. All right, let's get into our topic. So I'm really curious about this first one here, about how a journal has retracted a study on a weed killer. It seems a bit sketchy.
Yes,
to say the least.
And it very much is, actually. So this one needs a lot of sort of background. So there's a weed killer called Roundup, which I'm sure most people will have heard of.
Yes.
Which is the trade name of Monsanto for a thing called glyphosate, which was a weed killer that was developed way back in the 70s. And since that time, there has been a lot of argument as to its safety or not. And so because of this, it's been subjected to a heck of a lot of studies, both academic sort of studies and regulatory authority type people studies. So it's been very, very, very well studied, let's say. And these studies, plus some others, as we'll see, form the basis of what we call a review article way back in the year 2000. Mm. So a review article is where you basically look at the current state of the literature and you essentially put it into an article. You take all of those individual papers and you summarize them and write it as a sort of a coherent sort of article. And in this case, this particular review article looked at about 200 plus papers on Roundup and the safety thereof. And so this review article was written by two university academics, so one from the US and one from the Netherlands, and the head of a private Canadian scientific consulting firm. So, you know, they sort of had credibility enough to be able to write this sort of stuff. And so with this review article, as I said, they survey the literature, so the published literature. Plus, in this survey, they also had a number of unpublished reports that came from Monsanto and elsewhere. So these were sort of internal reports done by the company. And the final conclusion that they came up with at the end of this review article, they'd reviewed all of the literature, and the final conclusion, and I quote, was, "There is no potential for Roundup herbicide to pose a health risk to humans."
Right.
Which, now, there's all sorts of problems with saying something like that. There is no potential. Now,
like science zero, is nil, naught.
Science is never nil, naught, absolutely, you know. It's never an absolute. It's a, you know, 95% or something like that.
Yeah.
But never say never in science. So that was a bit of a mistake. Anyway, in the interim year, so there were a number, well, in fact, quite a few lawsuits that were brought against Monsanto because of Roundup in particular. And people claiming that they had got cancer because of the use of Roundup. And this being the US and juries being what they are in the US, not scientifically trained whatsoever, these were going against Monsanto at an enormous rate of knots and an enormous mass of money. So literally hundreds of millions of dollars in individual lawsuits were being awarded to these people who say they had developed cancer because of the use of Roundup. And so as part of all these lawsuits, in 2017... Monsanto was forced to reveal internal emails and stuff. And some of these internal emails said that this particular review article that had been published in the year 2000 was actually ghostwritten by employees of Monsanto.
Ooh.
Okay. And yeah. Yeah. So, you know, that's not a good look. So, no. You know, the supposed authors of these things, of this paper, did they actually write it?
Mm.
You know, and obviously it came out with a very favourable conclusion towards Roundup, you know, saying that it has no potential to, you know, cause any harm on humans. So as a result of all of this, this 2017, these papers that were made public, these internal emails. So on November the 28th this year, this particular paper from the year 2000 has now been retracted. And you might think, well, God, that's a long time to take for a paper to be retracted.
Yeah.
And the reason it was retracted was at least in part due to the efforts of two people, Naomi Oreskes, who's a historian of science at Harvard, and Alexander Kaurov, who is was a postdoc of hers, but he's actually now studying at Victoria University.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So where does all this leave us? So this paper's been retracted. So therefore, does that mean that Roundup is not safe?
Yeah.
Okay, that's the big question that everybody's asking. And the answer to that is not necessarily.
Mm.
Okay? So it's not a good look, obviously.
Mm.
But, okay, this is a very, very emotive issue, and there's arguments that have been for and against the use of Roundup. Tellingly, the New Zealand Environmental Protection Authority have recently decided not to reassess Roundup, the safety thereof, simply because of the fact that there's no significant new information about it.
Yeah, because I think it's still being used on like council property and stuff like that.
Oh, yes, indeed. Oh, no, it's very widely used. You go down to your local hardware store and you can buy it and everything. And, you know.
Are there any like warnings on Roundup at all?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yeah, absolutely there are. And, you know, you're meant to wear the appropriate safety.
Yeah.
You know, you're meant to be all gloved up, no bare skin, all of that sort of stuff that we chemists would take for absolute granted, you know, when you're working with things that are potentially hazardous. And it is, of course, it's potentially hazardous. Hell, it kills stuff. It kills weeds.
Yes.
Okay. So, this is one paper that's been retracted, okay? Now, as I said before, that's been the subject of many, many papers from governments, regulatory authorities, and all of these reviews worldwide. So basically, the net result is that, yes, it does appear that provided you use it in the suggested way, that you use it in small quantities and you're wearing the appropriate safety gear, then it is safe.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
However, having said that, they're absolutely right to retract this. Absolutely right, because they are violating all sorts of rules here when it comes to publication.
You can't, unethical.
You can't ghostwrite things. Yeah, you can't claim that people wrote it when they presumably didn't. Now, two of the original authors are now dead, so we can't go to them.
Yeah.
So they went to the third author and asked them what the story was. No reply.
Right. Okay.
So, yes, they were right to retract it. But the retraction does not mean that Roundup is all of a sudden harmful.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and I mean, as we often say on Dear Science, more research is needed on this.
Yeah.
But it's really, really, really not a good look.
Absolutely
not. For Monsanto, who were taken over by Bayer, which I never understood because they're in the middle of all of these multi-million dollar lawsuits and then Bayer, the big chemical company, actually buy Monsanto, plus they buy into all of these lawsuits. I never saw the sense of that.
Yeah.
So it's not a good look for them, not a good look for the journal that originally published it. But again, they were sort of probably ignorant of the whole thing.
You
know?
Yeah.
They didn't know that this had been ghostwritten. So
it's a tricky situation.
Scientific ethics, folks. Let's just stick to them, eh? Yeah.
Move on to our next topic. Yeah. Because this is probably one I'm a little bit more, not more interested in, but probably the most interested in out of our topics today, because I'm a huge cat person myself. Now, a cat's purr is, how do I put this? It's easier to identify an individual cat based off their purr from their meow, if I'm not mistaken, right? What's the study behind that?
Yeah, so cat owners out there, and I am one. I have three cats.
Lovely. I'm very, very glad to hear that. Very glad.
And so people who own cats would probably think that, you know, if they were going to identify them, they'd identify them by their meow, because that's sort of the obvious noise that cats make.
And I feel like a lot of domestic cats all have their own very unique meow as well.
Yes, indeed.
Like my flatmate's cat is different to how my cats at my parents' house meow.
Right. Yep. And as I say, you'd think as an owner that your cat's meow is unique and recognisable, but there's a bunch of workers in Italy and Germany who've started studying this and thinking, well, no, maybe not so much.
Mm.
And let's see if we can see if domestication has changed the way that cats meow.
Mm.
And can their meow then be used to identify them? That's the question. And basically, they found some interesting results. So the first thing they found was that meows are quite variable. So they are sort of situation variable.
Yeah.
So if you own a cat, you'll know that their meow is different if they want food or if they want attention or if they're sort of snuggling up to you at night on the couch or whatever. Okay, so they have different meows for different situations. And so therefore they don't have that one sort of consistent meow that can be used as an identification device.
Right, okay.
Okay. Now, you compare that with the wild cats out in the wild, the non-domesticated cats, and they seemingly don't do that.
That
their meows are a lot more diagnostic of who they are, that they don't vary according to the situation.
Okay.
So regarding that, these workers then went on and instead of the meows, they decided to look at their purrs. As you do. And so what they found was that, in fact, the purrs are very, very diagnostic because they appear not to change. That the way your cat purrs is the same pretty much all the time in all situations.
I was going to ask because I know some cats, I mean, obviously cats will purr if they're, you know, feeling comfortable and this and that. But there are also, you know, cats can purr when they're feeling stressed as well, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So I was going to ask if that would be different or if it's the same.
From what I read, they didn't really sort of go into that.
Okay.
But, you know, so they're sort of computer analysing the purrs versus the meows and everything, and they found that the purrs were a lot more invariant than the meows were. So, and comparing this, again, with the wild cats, that domestication does seem to have made a difference.
Interesting.
That cats over the years, as they've been domesticated, have learned to adapt their meows to, you know, the different situations that they find in a domestic environment they don't find in the wild, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
And so basically, your cat's purrs are the distinctive feature, the distinctive noise that a cat makes, much more so than the meows.
I would never have thought that either. I really would never have thought that. It's so interesting. Now, we don't have a lot more time of Dear Science, so we're just going to quickly jump straight into this last...
We shall?
Yes, topic.
Yeah.
Time is quicker on Mars.
Yeah, I know, and I didn't even know that, and really when you think about it, it's sort of obvious. But so Mars is smaller than Earth. It's about half the diameter of Earth. Okay, and now, so we go to good old Einstein's theory of relativity, and basically what that says is that in regions of low gravity, time goes faster.
Mm.
And in regions of high gravity, like your black holes and things like that, then time goes slower and et cetera, you know, and all sorts of weird stuff happens, okay?
Yeah.
And so, because Mars is smaller than Earth, then its gravity is less. And so, therefore, on Mars, time goes actually faster. So there's some workers in the USA who've done some calculations on this just very recently. And they calculated that on average, a clock on Mars will run, get this, 0.477 milliseconds faster over 24 hours than on Earth.
So like very, very slightly faster.
Yes, that's not very much. You wouldn't think. And again, this is all at sea level.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is at sea level on Earth. Now, Mars doesn't have a sea level.
Yes.
Does it?
No.
Okay. So they sort of picked this basically a height on Mars that they call the aroid, and they're sort of saying that that's equivalent to sea level on Earth. And so these are the numbers. And you might think, well, you know, 0.477 of a millisecond, we can forget about that. You can't really, because if we ever go to Mars and we've got things that we have to worry about, like communication and geolocation and stuff like that, GPS, okay, we always talk about GPS and how it's really, really accurate. It's only really, really accurate if we can measure it accurately, essentially, okay? And what you find on Earth. I mean, this manifests itself on Earth as well. You go to the top of a mountain, top of a high mountain, and time will go faster there because the gravity is less.
Yes.
Okay, and so you have to make some sort of allowance for the difference in height from sea level if you want GPS and everything to work absolutely perfectly. And, you know, all of this, you can imagine all of these communications and stuff like that, that if you're going to be communicating with Mars, you know, that's a long time, and a little period of time can balloon out to a large difference in time over that big distance, over that big time. So, you know, we do need to worry about these things. And that was just kind of interesting, I thought. So there you go. So time goes slower on Mars by about 0.4 of a millisecond.
Was it slower or faster?
Sorry, faster. Faster, because it's got less gravity. Its gravity is lower.
That's very interesting. Well, those are some very interesting topics. And thank you once again, Alan, for our last Air Science of the Year.
Yes, my goodness.
It's also nice seeing you again after so long as well.
Thank you very much. It's good to be seen. Yes.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Alan, for joining us.
Yeah,
thank you, MOTAT.
Yep.
And thank you, Science.
And yeah, can I just give a big shout out to MOTAT for, you know, sponsoring this over the year. It's absolutely fabulous. You can never have too much science.
Absolutely not.
So thank you for doing that, MOTAT.
And even though, like, I'm not usually the host of Dear Science, it is always really interesting me being in my office and hearing all sorts of different science-led topics that come on air. And they're also different as well, which is I really do appreciate.
Yeah.
Cool. Landing 20th December, Forces of Flight, MOTAT's newest Aviation Hall exhibition. Discover the forces that take you sky high. Thank you once again, Alan.
Cool.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.